Thank you for listening to this Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Now, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank Footman James for sponsoring Last Blast. As you know, at The Intercooler, we only partner with like-minded organisations, with companies that we think really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast. Footman James fit into that perfectly. I know this because when talking to them before making this recording, they said to me, please don't talk about car insurance, which I think says a lot. So instead, I'm just going to give you a couple of reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. Coffee and chrome, for one thing, that's Footman James' regular car meet. It's free to attend once you're registered, and it's where hundreds, if not a thousand, car enthusiasts get together with their classics to enjoy and share their passion for cars. Footman James also publishes its indicator report. It's a thorough analysis and a detailed report into the state of classic car ownership in this country. The point is to promote and safeguard the future of classic cars in the UK. So there you go, two good reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. So thank you, Footman James. Go and visit footmanjames.co.uk. You're listening to the Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. This week, Andrew Frankel talks to Formula One designer Adrian Newey.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a Last Blast podcast. With me today is the Chief Technical Officer of Red Bull Racing, Mr. Adrian Newey. Adrian, 184 Grand Prix wins with cars on your name so far, 11 Drivers' Championship, 10 Constructors. When I was doing the research for this, I realised in the last 30 years, in both the drivers and constructors, there's either a 1 in 3 or better than 1 in 3 chance that whoever won was in one of your cars. It's a fairly extraordinary record, isn't it? Is your hunger to win as much now as it ever was?
Yes, I think the competitive instinct is still there, but also I'm lucky enough to be doing exactly what I aspired to do from the age of about 10. And you know, at that point, through my kind of adolescence and teens and into getting my very first job at Fittipaldi's in Formula One, and after I graduated, then my ambition was to work as a designer in motor racing. Didn't have to be Formula One.
Was it in the blood? Is there a great family connection to motor racing, or was it just something that you found a connection to?
It's a good question. The honest truth is, I'm not exactly sure. My father was a vet, obvious connection, but he's also a great car enthusiast, not in racing, but in road cars. And he liked tinkering about, so he had a succession of Mini Cooper S's.
A couple of Lotus Elans.
A couple of Lotus Elans, exactly. Yeah. The second of which he bought in 1970. So by then I was old enough to help assemble it from the sort of kit that it arrived on the back of a lorry from. And then he set about tuning it quite a lot, so I helped him sort of get the engine in and out, and he fitted a ZF gearbox and some wide wheels. I'd learnt to fiberglass, so I made the wheel arches and all that sort of thing. And he also had a little workshop in the garden. And so I think possibly my first interest in racing was sparked by a Scale Electrics kit when I was about 8 or 9, and then started building models, particularly the one I most remember is a Lotus 49 12th scale Tamiya model. And those models were great because they showed you how a racing car went together, that all the parts were labelled, so you knew that the thing that held the front axle was called the front upright, etc. And the suspension articulated, so you saw how that worked. You obviously appreciated that the engine's bolted to the back of the monocoque. All the basics were there.
Yeah.
So I started building those when I was about 9 or 10. And then by the time I was about 12, I got bored of building effectively other people's designs. So I used my dad's workshop to sketched out, and then used my dad's workshop to start bending up bits of aluminium and make bits of fiberglass and so forth. And
did you make a functioning car? Or
I made several functioning, if you like, functioning or 12th scale models, cannibalising the Tamiya models. So using the bits I couldn't make, typically the engine, the wheels and so forth, but making the rest of it.
And by this stage, had you concluded that this was going to be your life, that what you wanted to do more than anything else was to design racing cars?
Yes, I would say so. I think the subjects I enjoyed most at school was without art. And so I spent all my time kind of sketching cars. As I said, then some of those sketches I'd attempt to make in the workshop using my dad's kit. I also started doing a bit of karting, so we kind of found in an exchange of Mart or something a go-kart for about 50 quid, which had a Villiers engine in it. So started taking that to Sheddington, which is a local kart track, and the combination of this and me were hopelessly uncompetitive. But again, the interest, actually more than driving it, was then trying to make it go faster. So I bought kind of bits for the engine, I started fabricating bits for it and so on and so forth.
But when you went to university, you did aeronautics and astronautics, not mechanical engineering or anything like that. And I wonder when you started thinking about aerodynamics being the sort of your major focus of your interest.
Well, that was... So I managed to get chucked out of school at 16, which was...
Well, can I just say, were you were obviously at school with Clarkson, but I think he's a couple of years younger than you. Do you remember him there?
I do remember him. I think he's 1 year below. Because the cart that I just referred to, I actually took that up to Repton, to the school, and then got on very well with the workshop manager there. So he let me in the evenings kind of work away and tinker about on the cart and use the school equipment. And I got it running and then started driving it around the chapel. And of course, being a racing two-stroke, it made a hell of a racket. So it wasn't long before the whole school turned out. And when I met Jeremy Single several years later, he said the thing he mainly remembered about me was that outing of the cart before it got closed down. Headmaster approached. But yeah, so I left Repton, got chucked out at 16. And then went a bit mad from 16 to 18, to be honest. I went to the local technical college, did a thing called an OND, an Ordinary National Diploma, not A-levels, which was not really A-level standard, to be perfectly honest. But I knew if I wanted to be involved in racing car design, then I needed a degree. And then to answer your question, I figured that racing cars were closer in that technology in terms of not just the aerodynamics but also the construction techniques, aircraft. They're effectively aircraft construction techniques.
Yeah.
So I felt that aeronautics would be a better course to study than mechanical.
Wow, okay. So we're already some way in. We haven't even asked you the first questions. These are the mandatory questions we ask everybody. So first of all, your first car.
My first car was a Morris Marina.
Oh.
It was bought for, I think, the princely sum of about £200.
1.3, I hope.
No, it was a 1.8.
Oh, wow.
1.6, I can't remember.
No, there was a 1.3. Well, there was a 1.8, yeah.
It was in a pretty poor condition. It was maroon with brown highlights, spots of rust everywhere.
Lovely.
But I was into hang gliding at the time, and it was the cheapest car I could buy that I could put a hang glider on the roof.
Was it an estate?
No, it wasn't an estate. It was a sort of fast, I guess you'd call it a fastback.
Yeah.
In reality, I didn't have a car until I was about 24. Well, that was my first car, but I was about 22, 23 when I had it. I just had motorbikes up until that point. So motorbikes were my passion.
Okay.
Kind of my teenage and early 20s.
Okay.
So I just needed something I could take the hang gliders of Wales in.
First crash?
In said marina, which was so my first year as a race engineer was in 1982 with John Ishikoso in a March Formula 2 car. So I was driving down from where I lived, which was just outside Oxford, to Thruxton early in the morning, and the marina had only three working brakes. It would have been the right front or the left front that didn't work. So every time you had to, every time you braked, you had to instantaneously, or at the same time, steer to the right to keep it in a straight line. It was quite early going down the lanes towards Thruxton, and a pheasant ran out. I was a bit sleepy, put the brakes on and forgot to turn at the same time, and promptly turned left into the ditch. So that was, the marina was a bit crumpled after that.
Did it survive the experience?
It survived. It was on its last legs anyway, so I don't think it did much after that.
First race?
First race as a driver.
Yeah.
First race as a driver was, where was it? What's the track up near Norfolk?
Snetterton.
Snetterton, thank you. So it was Snetterton in a Ferrari 430 challenge car.
Wow, that's a high level to go in at.
Well, yes, it was. It was because actually I've done various regularity rallies and so forth in my old pre-war Jaguar SS100. So I've done the Liège to Rome a couple of times, Mille, all that sort of thing. Had great fun in it, but got a bit bored of the regularity side of it.
Sure.
So I thought, okay, actually, I'd quite like to do the competitive side. So I rang a friend up in the States and said, look, I'd like to carry on rallying, but I'd like to do the competition side, not the regularity. And there seems to be lots of Porsche 908s and stuff on the competition side of these rallies. He said, well, yeah, I can find you one of those, but actually a GT40 is a much better car.
Yeah.
And I happen to have one for sale.
Yeah.
so I bought the GT40. I then rang up, having been to the revival and watched as a spectator, rang Charles Narch up and said, I've got this GT40 now, can I enter the race? And he said, yes, of course. Contact my competition secretary, which I did. He said, yep, absolutely. Just give me your race license number.
Oh.
And this is, it might sound ridiculous considering the business I'm in, but I had no idea I needed a race license. So a friend of a friend was a chap, Joe McCarry, who got...
Oh, you did Le Mans with him, didn't you?
Yeah, who I did Le Mans with many years later.
Yeah.
He was a ARDS instructor. So I got my test with him. Then, of course, I needed the six races. He's a Ferrari dealer, had a challenge car, so... That's what I did.
Most
of my six races.
Got your six races.
Yeah.
Got your license and off you went.
And my seventh race is Le Mans Classic in the GT40.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was that the one where it went slightly wrong?
No, that was a subsequent one. The first one was much more tame.
Let's start with your cars. Can we have the first car on your list?
Right, the first, so I read your kind of thing. So I think in terms of cars that made a big impression of me as a child, I would have to say it was the Lotus 49, partly because I think my dad with his Lotus Elans, and if you like, the brand that the family brand was Lotus.
Mm.
So that's who we followed. And at that point it was Graham Hill in the 49, in the Gold Leaf car. And also the first Tamiya 12th scale models.
Which you built, yeah.
It was also a Gold Leaf Lotus 49. So that kind of made a big impression on me as a child. The other car that I thought I just hugely admired for its natural beauty and engineering content was the Bluebird record car.
Yeah.
I think it,
the Donald Campbell
car. The Donald Campbell car.
Yeah.
Very elegant design.
Beautiful.
Aircraft engineers who worked on it, designed it, built it. So it was very much a four-wheeled aircraft. And actually, I didn't understand this at the time, but it was the first car really that properly used ground effect. So they used to...
I didn't know that.
Had a Venturi underside, and they used to tune the rear ride height by 2 or 3 mil at a time to try and get neutral lift, which is, late 60s.
Late 60s?
Yeah, absolutely.
I had no idea.
So I think those would be my first two.
Okay. Well, let's leave the others for a bit later on. We don't want to go through them all at the same.
Okay.
So you kick off your career as Johnny Cecotto's race engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you ended up at Fittipaldi?
Yes. No, sorry, other way around.
It was the other way around.
Other way around. So I start.
Oh, of course, yes, in March, then you went to America.
Yeah, I kind of towards graduation, then I started writing around to all the teams I could find addresses for. Most, of course, and obviously long before the internet, most didn't reply. Those that did reply came out with a catch-22 answer of only take people's experience. So it actually came down to Tiger, which was a small Formula One team, two teams, in Reading. They offered me a job as an aerodynamicist if such and such sponsorship came through, and of course it didn't. Exactly the same material, same thing. So I was kind of, by now it was July, and I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. When Harvey Postlethwaite from Fittipaldi rang up and said, can I come for an interview? So, yes, absolutely. Rode up from Southampton to Reading, where Fittipaldi was, on the bike. So sitting in the reception porter cabin in my leathers, and he came out and said, oh, obviously you've got a bike. What's a bike have you got? Ducati 900 SS, and which was actually a very flash bike for a
very
student.
Very fine motorcycle. Yes.
Yeah, my grandmother had unfortunately passed it a couple of years before, and left me a will, which I, much to my parents' disgust, I spent on Ducati. Exactly. He said, "No, I've got a Guzzi Le Mans, which was the big rival at the time.
Yeah.
Can I have a go on the Ducati? Be my guest." So he rode off around the industrial estate, big noise, you know, very noisy bike, so he could hear it. Eventually, come back about 15 minutes later, and big smile on his face, and said, "When can you start?" So that was my
fantastic
first and only interview.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you weren't there for long, were you? So this was 1980, I guess?
That was 1980, exactly. Yeah. I stayed for about 18 months until Christmas of 81, 82. Loved it, learnt a lot. I was hired as junior aerodynamicist, which turned out to be senior aerodynamicist as well. Because
there was that you were the department.
I was the aero department, exactly. Unbelievable by today's standards.
How many in the Red Bull aero department now?
Well, we had to shrink slightly because of the cost cap, but if you go back to 12 months ago, then we're probably about 70.
Right.
80.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Bit different.
Yeah. So did my 18 months there, but it became obvious that Fittipaldi was losing its sponsorship. So Harvey went to Ferrari, Peter Waugh, the team manager, went to Lotus, Peter McIntosh, the sort of assistant team manager, went to March. And so both Peter Waugh and Peter McIntosh offered me jobs at Lotus and March, respectively. Lotus would have been as an aerodynamicist. March was as a race engineer at the weekends and working as a junior draftsman during the week. And I felt like, okay, I've now had 18 months of experience as an aerodynamicist.
Yeah.
I'd like to learn about the other two disciplines, so I took the March job.
And soon found yourself in America.
Yes, so I did my year in F2 at the weekends with Johnny, who was a lovely lad, very, very patient with somebody that didn't know one end of the racetrack to the other. And then working on various projects during the week, Can-Am car and so forth. But towards the end of the year, there was a very unloved sports car that March had done for Group C. And having done my final year project on ground effect and aerodynamics applied to sports cars, closed roof cars at university, I went to see the boss Robin Hurd and said, you know, this is what I did my final year project on.
Yeah.
I've looked at the car and I think I could do something with it. And he said, okay, well, that's great, you can have a go, but be aware there's no budget for wind tunnel testing or anything, you'll have to just get on with it. So I did the car by eye, which is a
wow,
very, very dangerous thing to do. it was so heavily modified, the car that was existing,
yeah,
by eye. And Robin then sold it to a guy, an American guy, to race in Daytona for the 24 hours. So I turned up in Florida with another English mechanic. It turned out the guy I'd sold it to had a Ferrari Testarossa road car, one of those sort of slightly ugly things with all the slats down the side.
Yeah, Miami Vice car. Yeah,
exactly. And fancied himself as a bit of a racing driver, so as he would, he entered Daytona. He had three other drivers, Randy Lanier, Martin somebody or other, and what was the other guy? But Randy was actually very good. One of them kind of had the Benny Hill glasses, all you saw was the big eyes,
yeah.
And the other one had dilated pupils, had spent and lived on Daytona Beach appropriately enough. So I managed to persuade the team owner that perhaps, you know, maybe next year he should just step back and be team owner for this event. We were up for car kept breaking down. I mean, it's done almost no mileage.
Yeah.
So we were up kind of about 48 hours before the race had even started, qualified midfield, thinking break down after the first hour and we can all go back to the hotel. I can remember very clearly about kind of, I guess it must have been about 1 a.m, needing to go for a pee. So walking around to the loo block, and it had, same as Indianapolis, Daytona has this sort of tower that has the numbers of first, second, so. And I looked up and it said P1, number 66, and standing there having a pee. 66, I know that. Shit, that's a bit 66. And we'd completely lost track of where we were. We weren't even looking at the scoring. We were just trying to keep the car running.
Yeah.
And it just kept trundling around. And in the end, it got a bit of a misfire, about kind of 2 hours from the end of the race, but we finished second. And that really was what launched my career.
Wow. And then you did that for 2 years?
Well, I did GT.
And then you did
so that was the start of 83. Then off the back of that result, Al Holbert, who was a Porsche dealer in Pennsylvania, he wanted a car, but with the Porsche engine instead of a Chevy in the back. So he did an installation, put that in.
So this was before 962?
Yeah. Yes, just the 956 was around in Greece.
But weren't allowed to race an IMSA.
But weren't allowed to race an IMSA, correct. So we put the Porsche in, and he went on to win the championship that year. And so off the back of that, Robin Hurd said, okay, he had this sort of rent an engineer scheme with the teams that, IndyCar teams that bought Marches. So I was effectively rented out to True Sports, which ran Bobby Rahal for the 1984 season.
And is that when you met Bobby for the first time?
That's when I met Bobby for the first time. So I arrived really still, from a race engineering point of view, quite green. All wet behind the ears, done my year of Johnny in F2, but that was it.
Yeah.
And Bobby was brilliant. He kind of, you know, first race was Phoenix, short oval, 1 mile oval. And it's a whole new learning curve, ovals, because the car looks as if it's had the accident before it's left the pits. 1 degree of positive camber on the left rear and 4.5 degrees of negative on the right front, and all the springs are different.
It's
staggering. So it's a steep learning curve, but I mean, we've kind of floundered a little bit at the start of the season, but modified the car a lot through the season, and learned how to race engineer it. And so from the second half of the season onwards, we were the only March that could kind of challenge Mario Andretti in the Lola, and won, I think, a couple of races at the end of the year. So I've had an incredible kind of experience learning all that stuff. It was 1984, so I was still only 3 years out of university at that point, three and a half years out of uni. And so True Sports said, okay, we want to keep you for the following year. The 84 March was not a competitive car compared to the Lola, so Robin kind of took the huge leap of faith of putting me in charge of the 85 car design.
Yeah.
So I led the design team for that. We had, and indeed the 86 car that followed. And so, 85, 86, 87, we won Indy. And
Indy twice, the championship twice.
Well, actually, the 86 car won in 87 as well, so we won Indy three times and the championship twice.
Wow. Yeah. And was it March who called you back to Formula One?
So by the middle of 86, had the being out living in the States during the season, and kind of travelling from race to race, but then flying back across the Atlantic all the time to design the following year's car.
Yeah.
Was, of course, incredible experience.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I wanted to get back into Formula One. IndyCar was, as I say, from an experience point of view, a very good learning curve. But it was not at an engine. It was not at a level that. It was at one level below Formula One. That's the easiest way of putting it.
Yeah.
So ultimately, of course, I wanted to get into Formula One. Teddy Mayer, who ran his team with Tyler Alexander, had seen what he ran a team out in IndyCar, but then managed to land a deal to build Formula One cars for Beatrice Haas. So he said at kind of midway through 86, will you come and be technical director at Beatrice Haas, which I accepted the job. So kind of latter half of 86, I was then still racing Michael Andretti out in the race engineering, wow, Michael in the States, and then flying back to start at Beatrice, which is based just outside Heathrow. What Teddy didn't say is that, yes, I was going to be technical director, but he'd also effectively told Neil Oakley that he was kind of the boss, and Ross Brawn thought he was the boss, and Teddy's kind of approach was just throw everybody in together and let them fight it out, which I must admit didn't enjoy. That period of about 3 or 4 months was probably, I would say, the only period in motor racing which I haven't really enjoyed, because the politics just outweighed the kind of in the design enjoyment of the place. And it's interesting because then the team folded in November.
Yeah.
And then kind of mid 87, Robin attracted me back to, because he now had a Formula One project with his new partner, Leighton House.
Indeed.
So he came, asked me to come back and be technical director at Leighton House. So roughly 9 months after I'd left Beatrice, I was back into designing a Formula One car again. But whereas I'd been unable to really think of any new or original ideas at Beatrice, I think simply because of the politics of the place,
yeah,
I just found it quite stifling. Back at Leighton House, and maybe with the comfort of working with a lot of my old colleagues from the March days there,
yeah,
it became a real melting pot of kind of fresh ideas.
So that was your first season with Leighton House and March was 88?
Correct, yeah.
And was that the first Formula One car you'd done from the ground up?
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, it was the first. So, I mean, my very early work with Fittipaldi, but the car that we were designing for what would have been the 82 season, they basically didn't have the budget to build in the end, so yeah, we designed it, but it never
You designed it, but it never ran.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those years with March and Leighton House, they were promising, weren't they, given the size of the team relative
Absolutely.
To...
Yeah, I mean, we were tiny. In 88, running two cars, we were a team of about 45 people. So when the race team went out to a race, then there's almost nobody left at base. It was the design office, including aerodynamics, the total number of engineers in the whole place was five, including myself.
Yeah.
Compared to sort of well over 200 nowadays.
Yeah.
We were absolutely tiny. But the 88, once we kind of struggled a bit to start with, once we sorted the car out, then we were competing and at times beating certainly Ferrari and McLaren. So it was for such a tiny team with a Judd powered, normally aspirated V8.
It is amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, we had a good year.
But then it all went wrong, didn't it?
It did. So end of 88, you know, we finished up by being the only, we finished second in Estoril behind Alain Prost, but beating Ayrton Senna in his McLaren.
Wow.
And then went to Suzuka. Ivan in the wet was briefly actually overtook and was the only normally aspirated car to lead a lap that year. So he briefly led and then got overexcited, I think, on the gear change and knocked the ignition switch. And
that was that.
Killed the engine. So that was that. So had an amazing first year. And I suppose I became the darling of, if you like, the new kid on the block,
yeah.
The new star, which probably went to my head in truth a bit. You know, still, what was I, 29 at that point?
Yeah.
And it was an attitude of, okay, well, you think that one was good, wait for the next one. and the next one, the 89 car. Relative to the size of the team, was overly ambitious technically. It was the first mistake. So I think if I'd been working at one of the big teams, Williams or Ferrari or McLaren, then they would have coped with it. But as this tiny little team of 50 people, it was too ambitious. The other big problem was the aero side of it. So obviously the 88 car had been successful because of its aerodynamics. It was, I'd kind of taken what I'd learned from IndyCar and gone a very different direction to the norm of Formula One at that time.
Yeah.
Using the Southampton wind tunnel. What we hadn't, 89, we just struggled like mad. The car seemed to be aerodynamically unstable. We couldn't understand it. Everything seemed okay in the tunnel. It was a really demoralising year where kind of I started to question myself. You know, was it a 1 year flash in the pan? Should I have stayed in Indy and been a big fish in a small pond rather than vice versa, etc.? You have all these little confidence niggles and stuff. Very, very difficult year. I took the view for 1990 that there was no point in designing a new car, which there was a lot of pressure to do because until we understood what was wrong with this car, we could just make the same mistakes again. So the 1990 car was a very, very close evolution of the 89 car. Most of the parts were common. Thinking, but I thought in the wind tunnel maybe you'd understood the problem, so the few aerodynamic changes. Got to pre-season testing first race we didn't even qualify. It was a real career low point.
Gosh.
And we just couldn't understand it. And anyway, basically what it was, eventually understood, was that the moving ground at Southampton, which is effectively like a conveyor belt.
Yes.
It was an underneath the belt was an aluminium platen, but that aluminium platen was quite thin gauge aluminium that in turn sat on an oak bed plate. And the oak over the years had started bowing.
No.
So that, basically if we raced on a circuit which had a constant slight dip, we would have been the champions. But put it on a flat surface and the diffuser completely stalled, and that's what was going on. We had developed a car to a shape that was, of course, not reality.
And was it too? Presumably, it was too late by the time you found out what the problem was.
It wasn't too late. More or less, coincidentally, as we start, kind of, I think I put just a straight edge across the belt, and realised that was the problem, because when you set the model up, you only set it up at two points, the front and the back, so you don't know what it's doing in between. But at the same time, Robin Hurd had decided to invest and build a new wind tunnel in Brackley, which eventually became the Jordan tunnel.
Yeah.
And so we started testing what was now a 40% model in this new tunnel. And unsurprisingly, of course,
you understood immediately what the problem was.
And the diffuser was completely stalled and it didn't work at all. So as soon as we understood it, it's like all things, once you understand the problem, then it, generally speaking, becomes easy to fix it.
Yeah.
So we designed a new floor, new diffuser, put that on the car for the first race it had it on was Paul Ricard in 1990. Which is the race that I think Rich owned, Ivan qualified something like 8th or 9th, so big step up.
Yeah.
But then in the race, Ivan led just about the whole race until about two laps from the end when he got a bit of a misfire and finished second.
Wow.
So that was it was incredibly rewarding that we managed to understand the problem, fix it, and now had a competitive car.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, the politics in Leighton House had got completely out of control, unfortunately. Akira Akagi, who was the owner of Leysin House, Japanese owner, he had made his money in real estate, but it was all leveraged against banks. It was all loans, which is all, of course, was wonderful when real estate was going up. Yeah. When real estate crashed towards the end of 89-90 in Japan, then he was left in a difficult position, because effectively he created a Ponzi scheme with the banks. And so he didn't want to withdraw from his Formula One team, because that would send out worrying signals to the banks, but he wanted to run it on the shoestring. Ian Phillips, who's the team manager, he unfortunately contracted meningitis in Brazil at the first race, so he was out of action. And an accountant, Simon Sproul, was brought in effectively as team principal whilst Ian was recuperating.
Yeah.
So we had it was one of those perfect storms. We were on a very tight budget. The car wasn't performing, and Ian as the partnership between technical director and team principal is always a key one.
Yes.
In that relation, from my side, I'd lost that relationship, and now an accountant instead.
So you became completely demotivated, and
so isolated certainly, and everything was being kind of accounted and called and stuff. And so anyway, Keeble decided that, well, he kept falling out over everything and anything, and so he decided he wanted me out, and indeed managed to get me out about 2 weeks a week before Ricard. So I actually then, Patrick Head from Williams had approached me, and so I'd been stalling out and saying no, but then kind of as it got untenable to the point that eventually I was fired anyway, I'd said yes.
Wow. All right, well, just before we get on to the Williams era, can we have one more of your cars?
Yeah. Right, so I think the briefest cars I have and haven't driven.
So anything you like.
Anything,
road car, race car, whether you've driven it, haven't driven it, whether it was a picture on your bedroom wall, a car you designed, it could be anything you like.
Okay. Seems quite egotistical to put cars that I've been involved in, so I'll avoid that one. I think all these things, for me, it's not... Bedroom wall is, as you say, one of them. I think that would be the latest 49 in the Bluebird that we've already discovered. In terms of memories and therefore importance to me, then probably the next one would be the SS100.
Wow.
And that's because when I was out in the States, it starts because an old university friend had a silver model of an SS100 on his desk, and I always thought it was quite a pretty looking...
Beautiful car.
Car.
Yeah.
Heard of this when I was in the States. It was a bag of bits. So I bought it off a doctor who, I think, he'd stripped it. Usual American thing, chrome-plated a few pieces, and then unfortunately went through a separation and needed the money.
Yeah.
So I bought it as a stripped-down bag of bits, brought it back to the UK. The same friend knew of a chap in out towards Colchester, Terry Rowing, who wanted to build replicas. He's a huge enthusiast, but wanted one to kind of copy. So in exchange for rebuilding it, I gave him the bag of bits so that he could make his replicas.
Yeah.
So, in fact, most of the replicas that you now see around are
replicas of your car.
Yeah, my car. And he took his time, but did a great job of rebuilding it. And then, kind of, we had a lot of fun in that car. In terms of, I think I mentioned earlier, did a couple of Liège to Rome, the Mille Miglia, some rallies in Austria. Hill climb in France, all sorts of things. Just did a lot of with friends and family.
Yeah.
So a lot of happy memories in that car. And in fact, actually, just not this last weekend, it was obviously Paul Ricard, but the weekend before, did a rally in the Cotswolds with my daughter and the same friend, actually, Dave McRoberts. So, which was, it's just a great car to go out.
You've had it for a while.
I have, yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So back to, I'm mindful that, I mean, I could do this all afternoon, but I'm mindful your time is probably a bit more valuable than mine. So the call comes from Patrick, and suddenly you find yourself going from a very small team, you know, trying to make its way in the world to, you know, one of the biggest teams in Formula One. Was that an easy transition for you to make? I mean, with the successes speak for themselves, but for you personally, was it just wonderful to be able to have those sorts of resources at your disposal?
It was. So when Patrick initially offered me the job of head of research and development, which I think would have been, even in Williams, was a very small department, and I'm not sure ultimately is my strength, but I accepted because I wanted to, having worked for a small team and having had all this pressure on my shoulders for the previous year and a half where the car wasn't performing and stuff, I was actually a bit tired, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I fancied having the experience of working for a big team, and also, in complete honesty, the sort of slight safety net of not being overall responsible for the performance of the car.
Yeah.
So that's the position I was offered. I accepted for those reasons. And then, so I was due to start the week after Silverstone. So I think France, Ricard and Silverstone were consecutive weekends, if memory serves me well. Ricard has said, and accepted the job just before Ricard. Then we had the second place in Ricard, having led most of the race. And then at Silverstone, even with a cracked exhaust, Ivan set fastest lap in the race. So the performance of the car had completely turned around.
Yeah.
So when I started, Patrick said, look, you started at head of R&D, hired as head of R&D, but actually, would you like to be chief designer?
Uh-huh.
And I said, yes, of course. So the Monday of my arrival, I had a job title change and a position change. And really kind of, I think, based on the Patrick recognising that the aerodynamics of the Leighton House were pretty decent and so forth, he effectively, chief designer, was both mechanical design and aerodynamic design. Patrick loved gearboxes, so he specialised in the transmission and the general running of the factory and the infrastructure and all the important bits that I needed to learn anyway and certainly had no experience of from Leighton House because we were so tiny. And that partnership worked very well, so I then, you know, this is by now, I guess mid to late July, so quite a compressed timescale to get ready for the following season.
Yeah.
So effectively the car that I'd been working on for Leighton House became
FW14.
The roots of what was FW14. Actually, if you look at, say, a 901 Leighton House next to a FW14, you can see a fair family similarity. Surprisingly, wind tunnel facilities at Williams weren't very good. They had a little quarter-scale model, which was an old specialised moulding tunnel. Wind tunnel. And it really wasn't up to the job. So by now the Southampton had built a much bigger wind tunnel, which was capable of taking a 40% model.
Yeah.
Not the one we'd used at Leighton House. So it sounds bizarre now, but I took the view, we only had we had unlimited time in the Williams quarter scale model, but only something like 1 week a month in the 40% at Southampton. So I took the view we'd do all the upper surface bodywork in the quarter scale, and we'd do all the underside, the more critical bit in Southampton, which is a funny way of working.
Yeah.
We managed to get it to gel. Did the research and that became FW14. I got a bit of kickback when from Patrick when the car finally came out, because we started to realise that the more you could cut the wetted surface, the outside shape, tight around the driver's thighs and buttocks, the more aerodynamic gain you can get out of it. So built a mock-up, sat Nigel in it, Mansell, and kept whittling it away until he said, that's as far as I can possibly go. But having had a I guess rightfully, reputation for making overly tight cars of the Leighton houses, then there's a bit of concern there. And when Patrick found out about the final kind of whittling, but after the tub mould had been taken, then he kind of got quite aerated and said, I think you've gone too far again. But luckily,
it was the right.
Just about got in. Yeah.
And then FW14B.
Yeah.
And that season.
So 14 was 14, the 91 season. The car was competitive from the start. We had a transmission problem where we kept breaking one of the gear dogs. So we retired from the first race, Phoenix, because of that. The second race, because nobody understood it, but it always seemed to be the sixth gear, the top gear, that was damaged. We were elected to run it as a five-speed. And when I think Nigel broke down with another transmission failure. And when we stripped it down, despite having never used sixth gear was damaged, and we realised that what was actually happening was the shafts were shunting backwards and forwards. They hadn't got enough lateral control. So easy thing to fix once we realised what the problem was.
Yeah.
The next race was Montreal, and Nigel was leading comfortably when he waved from the crowd and forgot to downchange at the final hairpin, which was absolutely gutting, because that would have been my first win, and I would have been completely distraught about that. But then Ricardo won at the following race in Mexico, and from there we had a good season. Reliability still affected us from time to time. We had a ECU failure at Spa, a few other bits and pieces, so reliability probably cost us the championship, but the performance was there. Having said that, towards the end of the year, then McLaren did improve their performance, and probably by the end of the year, Suzuka, then they actually had the quicker car again. So I've been working on a car for, what was the 92 season, FW15. But at the same time, we were developing the active car.
Yeah.
And it became clear that the active car, because you could exploit the aerodynamics so much more, was going to be a big performance leap. So then what do we do? How do we concentrate our resources? And the answer, of course, was the best thing to do was concentrate on making the 14B, the active car, reliable, rather than doing a 15 with active that potentially would overstructure and be unreliable.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what we did.
And 1992 was utterly dominant, wasn't it?
It was. We did have an active failure in pre-season testing, and Nigel had a fair old kind of hissy about it and wanted us to just race the 14A.
Yeah.
And I do remember, I don't think Patrick was there that day. I took him to the truck and said, look, we can, but the bottom line is McLaren were quicker than us at the end of last year. If we race 14A, we're going to get beaten. So we really need to get this to work. And he accepted it, and we just got on with it. And actually, during the season, we didn't have a single problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, by Hungary, we'd done and dusted.
Done and dusted by Hungary. Wow. Yeah. And then Prost, 93.
Yep.
Imagine that working with Nigel and working with Alain, fairly different experiences.
Very, yes. Chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Nigel is very much a Marmite character.
Yeah.
But I thought he was great. Enjoyed working with him. The great thing about Nigel was when he got in the car, you knew what it was capable of. And he, that active car effectively was built for him. Not deliberately, but effectively, because he had incredible self-belief in his car control and in himself. And the car was actually a bit of a funny car, the 92 car more than the 93 car, because the active was a system which effectively was like a three-legged stool, where the roll control was almost done from the back. And that meant that when you first entered the corner, it was like entering a corner in a Reliant Robin until the system sorted itself out.
Right.
And it became normal. So the initial entry point, the car was quite unstable. And then, say, give it a few, half a second later, then it would all be fine. Ricardo never got over that feeling that the car was going to spin on him, and he would always give it that extra lift on entry, whereas Nigel just
powered on through it,
had confidence that the car would work, he would catch
backed himself and back the car. And then we come to 94. I don't want to dwell on it, but I was reading your book last night. If you haven't got it, Adrian's book, How to Build a Car, is a riveting piece of work. I recommend it to anybody, and you haven't paid me to say that. But no, 94, you were very, very honest in the book about what happened at Imola. And although you were found twice not to be to blame for what happened there, I got the sense that you felt in some way, at least partly, responsible. And I just wonder whether that's something that you still feel.
Yeah, it's something you never... something you never get over, I think, is the reality. So, we, in my opinion, we will never know exactly what happened that day. We know that the steering column was broken after the accident. What we will never know is whether it caused the accident or not. And you can very much look at that in two ways. Scientifically, it's difficult to see how it did cause the accident, because the car, you look at its, we had limited data, but we had effectively a torque sensor on the steering column, and but not a position sensor, and we had various other bits of telemetry and or data recording, I should say. The car understeered, initially oversteered over a bump, and then it went straight. So the simple explanation, of course, is that he oversteered. Ayrton caught it, and in the process of that moment, the steering column snapped, and then all he could do was hit the brakes, and what happened, happened. The alternative explanation is that it oversteered. He actually, at that moment of oversteer, he lifted to half throttle, which
you'd expect.
You'd expect to try and reduce the, the side load the rear tyre's got to carry. And the steering torque falls, which again you can explain by, if he's applying a bit of opposite lock or reducing the positive lock, then that's exactly what would happen. And then, so he goes to half throttle, holds it for a period of, I can't remember, about half a second or so, and then at the same time as the steering column falls, and then he gets hard on the brakes.
Yeah.
So an alternative explanation is that the rear snapped sideways, he went to half throttle, he applied opposite lock, stayed like that for half a second. It then high-sided him, which is the sort of IndyCar accident you see on the speedway all the time.
Yeah.
And where the driver catches it, but then it grips and it flings him to the outside wall. And so that's the alternative explanation. Now, which it is, I say.
But was there not something about, there was something on the track, and the fact that the car was sparking even more on that lap than it had the lap before?
Correct. So that is the other evidence that points it towards it being, in my opinion, a likely but not definite explanation is that the car had a right rear puncture. Because the first lap after the safety car pulled in, car was sparking lightly through Tamburello.
Yes.
And the rear did step out. He corrected it. The second lap through, it's sparking much more heavily, which it shouldn't have been, because he's going at the same speed, but with, by then, the tyre pressure
back
should
to
have
pressure.
Built.
Yeah.
So there's nothing broken on the rear suspension, so the only other explanation is a right rear puncture.
Yeah. Okay. So...
And if we looked at the other tests we did at Williams, was we took, you can, a broken component, you can look at what's fatigue and what is actually rapid failure, if you like. And yes, the component did have fatigue failure on it. So I think about
third. The component being the column.
Yeah, the column, sorry.
Yeah.
Had fatigue failure.
Yeah.
The design detail of it was absolutely appalling, for which ultimately, as the chief designer, I must take responsibility. I didn't design the component myself, but equally, I didn't spot it, and we didn't have a checking system in place that caught what was an appalling piece of detail design.
Yeah.
So it was cracked, there's no doubt about that. We did tests afterwards where we basically put a hacksaw through a new column to simulate the amount of cracking it had as opposed to sudden failure, and proved that with that amount of crack or failure to it, it was still more than capable of transmitting the torque that was required.
Yep.
So that again points to it not being the column. But I think there's two things. First of all, there'll always be that nagging doubt.
Of course.
And secondly, the bottom line is that a car that I had mechanically and aerodynamically been responsible for, somebody passed in, and that's not an easy thing to deal with.
No. But we'll move it on. As a team, picking yourself up after that, I'm mindful of the way that Graham Hill sort of picked up Lotus after Jim Clark died. And then Damon must have had to play a similar sort of role with Williams after that. It must have been. And also at the time, there was always this stuff, wasn't there, about what Benetton were doing and whether they were using traction control and everything else. I mean, there must have been. If you felt that you were not fighting on a level, I'm mixing my metaphors terribly here, playing field, on a level playing field, that must have been even more difficult for you to, you know, to get on with after an event like that.
It was. I mean, I think, as I said, we'll never know what actually caused the accident. What I do know is that Ayrton, he was taken out, I think, by Mika, if memory serves me well. But anyway, there's a first corner accident at the preceding race. And so Ayrton watched the rest of the race from the marshal's hut. And he came back from that race absolutely convinced that Schumacher's Benetton had traction control. So he went into Imola kind of convinced that he was fighting an unfair fair battle against an illegal car. And I think he'd lost the first three races through reliability and accidents and so forth. So he went into that race absolutely determined that this time he was going to get his championship aspirations back on track. So he's definitely driving hard. And I think if Damon said the line he took through Tamburello, Damon would not take, because he said yes, it was slightly quicker, but it was so bumpy on that inside line that he just felt the car was too unstable. Ayrton, of course, with his phenomenal self-confidence and car control, was prepared to take that. But also, I think he was so determined that weekend because of this feeling of battling against an illegal car. And in truth, subsequently, it turned out that traction control was only the start of what was illegal about that car. So that I think, was a big thing. And yes, through the year it became quite a bitter championship because of these concerns about the legality of the Benetton. But your point is absolutely right, and by some kind of incredible twist of irony that the team's now lost its star driver, just as Jimmy Clark was probably the star driver compared to Graham.
Yeah.
And now the Hill was suddenly promoted into that position. And of course, Graham had, at that point, had won. He was a world champion already.
Yes.
Tremendously experienced.
Yeah.
Damon was in his second proper season.
Of course.
And to be fair to Damon, he did a spectacular job of kind of, you know, first of all, coming into the factory and doing some of these tests I just referred to.
Yeah.
But then more than that, kind of, you know, just getting his head down and getting on with it.
Yeah. And so that was 94, 95. Well, I mean, it was Damon and Michael, wasn't it? Then finally 96, when Damon does it, that must have been a great moment.
Yeah, it was. No, it really was. I think 95, unfortunately, we had a very good car in 95 and really should have won the championship, and that was a championship that we let slip away, at least in part because Damon wasn't, whereas he'd done a spectacular job in 94, I think he would himself would admit that 95 wasn't his best year. The media had kind of created the sort of Hill Schumacher hype.
Yeah.
And I think Damon just allowed himself to be drawn into that too much rather than just ignoring it and getting on his driving. And he went away the winter of 95, 96. I think spent some time with Georgie and so forth, his wife, and came back a different person. And his driving in 96 was absolutely superb. And I think...
And was it helpful that Michael was not in a competitive car for that season?
Possibly, but I think even if he had been, I think Damon was a different he was a different person in 96 to 95.
Yeah. So you must have very happy memories of that season.
I do have very happy memories of that year. It was a very good year. I was kind of we lost one of our race engineers, David Brown, who had been Damon's race engineer in 95, left for McLaren. And I've always enjoyed doing a bit of race engineering from my IndyCar days. We decided to promote internally a chap, Tim Preston, from the design office to be Damon's race engineer. But prior to the first test, he hadn't worn a set of headphones. So wow. I kind of stepped in as Damon's, if you like, proxy race engineer, did all the races, and really enjoyed it, actually. So... kind of for him to win the championship, I think it was thoroughly deserved for what he'd done for the team, particularly as he didn't have a drive for the following year, as Frank has done his normal.
Is that the world champion, exactly.
So it was a very rewarding year.
And so to 97, it was obviously Jacques, and that was your car as well. But you then left to go to McLaren. And I wonder why that was.
I suppose it was primarily that, so I'd now been with the team since mid-1990. We had in that space had a decent level of success.
Yes.
And I felt that kind of I had played a part in that success. Now, the team was always run as Frank and Patrick's hobby shop, in truth.
It was
lovely for it, that, don't get me wrong. it was a proper family business, but I just felt that I would like to be more involved in some of the major policy decisions, because they did also affect the performance of the car, which is ultimately what I was interested in.
So things
like driver choice, engine choice, tyre manufacturer choice, all those key things. I felt I now kind of, if you like, had earned my stripes in terms of being involved in those. And yeah, my relationship would never be as strong with Frank and Patrick as their relationship with each other.
Sure.
I still wanted to be involved. And so in kind of extending my contract at the end of, I think it must have been 92. My initial contract, I think, was 3 years, but try and re-sign a year out.
Yeah.
By then, Frank had already done his thing of getting rid of Nigel, because he wanted Alan, and Alan didn't want Nigel. So part of Alan's contract was that Nigel could not be his drive in the same team. And I felt that was quite unfair. So I had put in my contract that I should be involved in driver choice. And that was fine. Obviously, we all agreed with Ayrton being signed. No dispute there. But then when it found out that Damon is effectively out of it... Well, sorry, go back one. In summer of 95, then DC was... off to David Coulthard was off to McLaren.
Yes.
And so it was who was going to replace David. Jacques Villeneuve's name was mentioned. And so we agreed that we'd give him a test, and I think Damon went out and set a benchmark time around Silverstone. It was a 2 or 3 day test to give him time to acclimatise, and if he was within 2 seconds by the end of the test, then we'd give him another test, was the agreement. In the event, he was about 3 seconds off.
Right.
So I went away on holiday, thinking, well, that's obviously that.
Yeah.
Read halfway through my holiday that Villeneuve has been signed for the 96 season. And it was that and various other things that I was kind of upset about. So again, went to see Frank and Patrick's voice minds, kind of, and yeah, we won't happen again. Don't worry.
Yeah.
We'll make sure that's the last time you'll be properly involved. And then, blow me, kind of 12 months later, Patrick leans over on the flight back from Spa and says, by the way, you may have heard, but I said, just in case you, I just wanted to be the first one to tell you that actually we've decided to hire Hayden's Harold Frentzen for next season. So yes, it'll be Frentzen and Villeneuve. And I was just absolutely gobsmacked, to be honest. I mean, first of all, I developed a good relationship with Damon.
Yeah.
But, you know, professionally things happen. It was the fact that, yes, again, I hadn't been informed. This is now the third time it had happened.
Yeah.
And it was clear nothing was going to change.
Yeah.
So it was either accept that's how it's going to be or move on.
Yeah.
And Martin Whitmarsh from McLaren had been kind of staying in contact with me since about mid-92, kept offering, and I kept saying, no, thank you, I'm happy where I am.
Yeah.
So when he rang up, kind of, I think, more or less opportune timing of kind of just after Frank had told me that on the way back from Spa, he rang up, we met, and
that was that.
Okay, that was that.
Let's have another car.
Good. So on the kind of on the same thing as the SS100s, kind of cars that are personal for the memories, then I would be torn between the GT40 and my lightweight E-Type. Both obviously primarily race cars, both cars that can be driven on the road.
Yeah.
Have been driven on the road. I think the GT40 I've had some great memories in from racing, doing some road rallies.
Yeah.
The E-Type, I think, is possibly I give it to that simply because of the races at the Revival.
Yeah.
And the ability, because they've been two driver races,
yeah,
to share it with friends.
Who have you shared it with over the
Bobby Rahal, Gerhard Berger, Martin Brundle. Yeah, those are the three.
Yeah, wonderful.
And it's been great sharing it with those people. And we've had some great results around Goodwood, so.
Yeah, brilliant. So you now find yourself at McLaren, working with Ron. Mm. Culturally, a bit different, I would imagine, to the Frank and Patrick show.
Very much so. I think when Ron kind of, or McLaren, the way it operated, when you go in, if you didn't walk through the race bay, you'd be hard pressed to know what was being made there.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way Ron kind of liked it, that he liked this sort of image of it being a high-tech business that could be making anything.
Yeah.
It just happened to be making racing cars. The original building, or the building I worked in to start with for the first 3-4 years, was a bit like we have here at Red Bull. It was a pretty average piece of architecture, just a typical industrial estate building on an industrial estate. And I like the honesty of that. It doesn't pretend anything it's not meant to be. It's just concentrating on its core business of making the best racing cars it can.
Yeah.
And the first kind of that time, Ron and I had a very good relationship with Martin, so it was a proper three-way relationship, if you like. Ron did stick to his word and thoroughly involved Martin and myself in all the key policy decisions and so forth. It all worked very well. Ron did nearly, I thought he was going to have a heart attack about 2 weeks in, So I joined on the 1st of August, and Ron wanted me to come along to a race, which, so the next race was Hungary, which I went along to. But by then I'd been working there for about 2 weeks and inherited John Barnard's old office,
right,
which was kind of floor to ceiling mahogany wood panelling, dark wood panelling, with black window frames, a mahogany desk, dark brown carpet, black chair, I think, I can't remember. So anyway, when you're working, I was working crazy hours trying to catch up because it was a very late start, 1st of August. I was working kind of good 12 hour, maybe more days,
yeah,
very often well past midnight. And by the end of that, it was getting, you know, this darkness was getting a bit depressing. So I said to the factory manager, look, while I'm in Hungary for the race, can you brighten it up a bit? Here's a colour, a Farrow & Ball colour chart.
Yeah.
I quite like the duck egg blue. So can you do the, repaint the panels, duck egg blue, get me a lighter brown chair or something and say a light beige carpet. Yep, no problem. So I went away, came back on Monday, and it done it all. Incredible, really, just in a few days. And it completely transformed it. Now felt bright and cheery and everything. Anyway, that evening, that Monday evening, Ron came in about 6 o'clock, and he stood in the doorway, and he started gulping like a goldfish, and started going more red and then purple. I thought he's going to have a heart attack, and he finally spun on his heels and walked out. The Ron's favourite colour is grey.
Right.
And he doesn't...
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. And the whole McLaren building, even the old one, was shades of grey.
Yes.
So to see this colourful office...
Yes.
And something that had been done without his knowledge or control...
Yes.
...was just...
Yes, I can imagine that wouldn't compute very well in the...
Yeah. Years later, I was chatting to his wife, Lisa, who's still a very good friend, and she said he got back from that evening. He said, that's it. He's going.
Well, luckily for him, you didn't, because you had, the first two seasons were fantastic, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. No, we had two. There's quite a big rule change between 97 and 98. Narrow track cars, various other aerodynamic regulations, plus the change to groove tyres. And I think that allowed us to come up with a very different car. There were some loopholes we exploited in the regulations in terms of the cross section of the monocoque. The narrow track, most people tried to go in proportion that, okay, if the track's narrow, we should shorten the wheelbase.
Yeah.
I felt that actually, because so much of a car's performance is on corner entry, if you've lost kind of, if you've now got more weight transfer onto the outside front tyre because the wheelbase is shorter, the best way to compensate for that is to make the wheelbase longer.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what we did. So we had a much longer wheelbase than anybody else. And the car worked pretty well. So we had a very good first year, won both championships. Second year, Schumacher broke his leg at Silverstone. But people forget is actually Mika was leading the championship at that point anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not like suddenly we lucked into it.
No, sure.
I think we almost did the opposite. We actually fell asleep. So then we started making all sorts of stupid mistakes.
It was quite close at the end, wasn't it?
And it was very close at the end.
Yeah.
But through our own, in truth, I think through our own complacency, we just let too many events slip through our fingers almost because it seemed too easy.
And then we start, there was that period, wasn't there, Ferrari dominance. I can remember...
Well, you say that, sorry to interrupt, but...
No.
Yeah, I mean, it was, of course. But 2000, we just also had a good car. And going into Indy, which is, I think, about two or three races from the end, again, Mika was leading, I think he was leading the championship. But we just started... The engine started to become very unreliable. So Indy leading the race, engine failure, Schumacher went on to win the race. And when you're that close to the end of the season, you suddenly drop, in those days, I think it's probably 10 points. It's just too much to recover from.
Yeah.
So with better reliability, would have won the championship in 2000.
Yeah.
And actually, the story that isn't known is that Schumacher was on the verge of joining for 2001, but when he saw how unreliable we were in 2000,
he
decided not to join. Yeah.
Gosh, no idea. But there was a time when you weren't going to be there in 2001. I can remember sitting in the Autocar office.
Yeah.
And I think I got a press release. I think a press release actually went out. If it didn't go out that you were going to join Jaguar, it was certainly very well known, wasn't it?
It was. I think it was a little bit later than 2001. I think it's more like 2003. By then,
maybe you're right. Yeah.
We moved into the new factory in about 2002 or so. And if I'm honest, I hated it. It was just very, very, it was the opposite of what you needed to try and be creative in. It was very clinical. The racing cars were even more distant, so had even less idea what you meant to be doing.
Yeah.
Very big open plan offices. To go in, you were meant to go down through these, I think they're called rotundas, circular spiral staircases, along a white corridor, which felt like you're going into a funny farm.
Yeah.
You pop up another one and into your place of work. And And I think in the early days, it was actually that you weren't even allowed water at your workplace, which must be against some human rights. You had to put everything away at night. You were allowed one family photograph on your desk and that was it, but that had to be folded away and put in a drawer at night. And it was just very stifling. No colour. I remember saying to Ron, I just think the building could do with a bit more colour. He said, Adrian, don't worry, come in here. And we went in an unused room, and there against the wall was a picture but facing the wrong way. So proudly turn it around and so that you could see it. And it was a picture of a silver Mercedes McLaren SLR on a grey gravel with a black granite background.
This is your idea of colour.
Exactly. Yeah. So I still enjoyed my job, but I didn't enjoy that building.
Yeah.
I found it quite stifling. The other thing was starting, as a result of, so I started to not enjoy the job, and then Bobby, my old friend from Bobby Rahal,
went to Jaguar.
Was now team principal at Jaguar.
Yeah.
And he approached me. I thought, well, you know what, I've been lucky enough now to have worked for two great teams with Williams and McLaren. Both teams that were winning races and championships long before I joined. Hopefully on both teams when I joined, I was able to bring something on the design side.
Yes.
But the infrastructure was all there. So the kind of, I've still felt a pang of regret at leaving and being forced into leave Leyton House. And the sort of the opportunity to, as we were doing at Leyton House, start again.
Yeah.
With a fresh sheet of paper,
yeah,
and develop a team from more or less scratch,
yes,
and see where we could get to. It was one that I kind of felt was unfinished business.
Yeah.
So the opportunity to work with Bobby, the opportunity to do exactly that, was an appealing one.
Yeah.
And I just felt, I felt slightly jaded. I suppose I felt I needed a new challenge.
Yeah.
That was probably the best way of putting it. So I started talking to Bobby quite seriously. Told Ron that this is what I was going to do. And then actually took the kids to the cinema to watch, what was it, The Mummy's Mummy's Revenge or Return or something. Return of the Mummy, that's it.
Right.
And turned my phone off, of course. A good cinema goer. Came out and my phone had about 500 messages on it. All hell had broken out while I'd been in the cinema because Ron didn't take it well.
Yeah.
And Ron is incredibly persuasive.
Yes.
And so he pointed out, which was fair, and I'd started to sense it myself, that Jaguar with stroke Ford, then the manager or the management kind of would tend to be a revolving door type policy, that Bobby might not last that long. Nicky was being involved in. Nicky, I didn't know Nicky at that time at all.
Yeah.
He had a very mixed reputation, let's say, within the paddock, of could be very hard and on his workforce, etc. Very dogmatic. And I was a bit nervous of that. If I was going to join you, I was going to join because of my relationship with Bobby.
Mm.
But it started to become evident that Bobby was not in himself in a completely secure footing. And so if I joined and then Bobby got hoofed out, what would I have?
Mm.
So I didn't know Nicky. Subsequently, many years later, I got to know Nicky much better, and he was an amazing person. And so in many ways, I now regret not having had the opportunity to work with Nicky as well as Bobby.
Yes.
But I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
Ron did a great number. And persuaded me to stay.
So you stayed on for, I think, another couple of seasons. But then actually in 2006, you end up effectively at that team.
Yep.
A couple of years late, but presumably a lot of the faces were the same, but it's called Red Bull now.
Indeed. So I think after that, then Ron persuaded me to stay. But I think unknowingly, and understandably, to be fair, Ron said to Martin Whitmarsh, make sure that we are never ever put in that position again where we have a technical director who's effectively become too powerful.
Right.
Well, we have become too dependent on him, is a better way of putting it.
Yes.
So Martin then came up with what was called the matrix system, where you had a head of aerodynamics and a chief of aerodynamics and a head of DO and a chief mechanical designer and so on and so forth. And it was just a mess, to be perfect. Yeah, it's too clumsy.
Yeah.
Too many cooks. So, that little group started to become too powerful. To the point that I was starting to lose technical control of the direction, which I'd never had before. To be fair to Patrick, he had always completely let me get on with it.
Yeah.
Whereas now, for the first time in my career, I was actually effectively kind of not free to do what I wanted, technically. And so I thought, okay, it's got to be time to move on. And so through the 2005 season, which we had a very good car in 2005, I think we won 10 races, but somehow managed to lose the championship.
Yeah.
And Christian Horner, who was the team principal for this new startup team Red Bull that had taken over Jaguar, kept walking the opposite way down the pit lane, or down the paddock, I should say, and kind of bumping into me and chatting and so forth. And
so accidentally on purpose.
Yeah, I'm sure it was accidentally on purpose. And so we started chatting more and more, and I thought, actually, you know, back to this thing, I'm not that happy at McLaren now. I'm still enjoying the job, don't get me wrong, but didn't feel right, and back to this thing of unfinished business of like to be involved in the team, right?
And they were, it was absolutely the ground floor for Red Bull, wasn't it? I knew they took over an existing team, but this was that you mean you joined in their second ever season,
And it at that point it was very much the ashes of Jaguar, so there's a bit of new blood, that Christian had brought in, but mainly it was still the Jaguar team. And it was, in truth, it was the joke of the pit lane, it was known as the party team, but nobody took it seriously, and they, they continued to finish seventh, just as they always had done in the constructors. So it was a great opportunity, and I took it.
Let's have one more car. I think this is your fifth coming up.
My fifth. So the car that I've probably, in the summer months, I'm lucky enough. Joe McCarry, who we mentioned earlier, many years ago, I don't think I could afford it nowadays, he found a Ferrari California for me, which is an original 60s one. And that, on a summer's day, is just wonderful.
Yes. Yeah.
And so
So an original 250.
Yeah. And so, again, had a lot of fun with that, with my wife, with children and so forth. Driven it a fair bit. That's the sort of
still
default
have
summer's days. Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Great car.
A short wheelbase, long wheelbase?
Short wheelbase. Must admit, took the original engine out and put a 4-litre in it just to make it pick its nose off a bit. And the 5-speed box just to make it a more comfortable modern-day car. But it drives incredibly well.
Yeah. Beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So the early Red Bull days, you join in the 2006 season. It's 2009 before it wins a race.
Mm.
And you've got DC and you've got Mark Webber driving for you. Was there always a sense of momentum building within that team in those early years?
I think when I first started, I made the mistake of, despite what I've been talking about, I made the mistake of making it too much of a design project and not enough of trying to get the right infrastructure in and the right people. So the first car for which I was responsible for, which was the 2007 car, it was an okay car. It was still a midfield car. Then started to concentrate a bit more on personnel. There were a few bad eggs within the team. Once I kind of started to form an opinion more and more of who those were. So eventually, it was about 5 people. We unfortunately had to show them the door because they weren't prepared to change. And having made those changes, then actually the people who were split on their loyalties suddenly came really strong people as well. So it almost changed the personality of the team overnight. It was quite remarkable. So I think that was important. We made some other changes. Any Formula One team effectively has 3 departments, which is the, now roughly speaking in order of size, typically the aerodynamics, mechanical design, and vehicle dynamics, which would include simulation and race engineering. Those 3 bodies were split. 2 of them, mechanical design and aero, were in this original building 1, which was the original Stewart Grand Prix building, but into completely different parts of the building. And then vehicle dynamics was over the other side of the road, which, it's only a 50-yard walk, but it's psychological. It's removed.
Mm.
So the communication between the 3 departments was poor, and that meant that typically kind of at a detail level, aerodynamics would design a shape and then vehicle design would put its own interpretation on that shape, let's say. kind of feedback from race team to aero to mechanical design was poor, etc., etc. So we put a big mezzanine out to get all the engineering disciplines in one area and make sure that as much as possible you could have communication verbally rather than by email.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in that. Let's have it round a desk rather than around somebody's CAD screen or something rather than endless emails and meetings and so forth. So tried to reduce the meeting culture, encourage more face-to-face. Upgraded the facilities, the wind tunnel at Bedford. We started building a much better driving simulator so that we could get better feedback on the vehicle dynamic side of it. All those changes started, they're changes that take time.
Yeah.
The big opportunity then really was we knew there was a big regulation change coming. And that regulation change was originally scheduled for 2008.
Yeah.
Season. I took the view through 2007 that actually a big regulation change could be our big opportunity, but we weren't ready as a group to react to that regulation change. So actually one of my kind of small triumphs, if you like, was that we managed to get the regulation change delayed for a year to 2009. And by that time, we were in much better shape in terms of our infrastructure, our people, our tools, to be able to take advantage of it. And so our breakthrough really was the combination of getting the right people in place with the right tools, coupled with a new regulation that meant everybody had a reset.
Yeah. And you got Sebastian in 2009.
Yeah.
And the wins started and they kept on coming.
They did. I mean, as a team, well, we had two things in 2009. First of all, there was the double diffuser row, of course, which was, in the end, not a technical discussion. It was a debate. It was as a political debate.
Yeah.
Max Mosley, the then FIA president, was having a huge row with Ferrari and McLaren, who expected to dominate the championship.
Yeah.
So, because they didn't have a double diffuser.
Yes.
Then I think Max decided that double diffusers were allowed, and the fact that Brawn and Williams had one was fine. He was quite happy with
quite
that.
Quite helpful, yes.
We, of course, were on the wrong camp for that particular one.
Yes.
So that disadvantaged us early in the season until we got our double diffuser working properly. And also, as a team, our infrastructure, our sharpness on race team, so forth, it still wasn't quite there. So we had too many silly mistakes early in the season. Scored more points than Brawn in the second half, but yeah, it was a bit too late. But as you say, it was a breakthrough season. Quite a few wins,
yeah.
Quick car.
And then four championships on the trot.
Mm. Yeah. 2010 was, that was a long, hard slog of a season. Very tight battle with Ferrari all the way through, and McLaren not far behind.
Yeah.
So that kind of winning the constructors in Brazil, the penultimate race, was amazing. But it's funny, we didn't really celebrate that much because we wanted to try and get the double if we possibly could, get the drivers as well. So to kind of get that on the last lap, effectively, in terms of, we didn't know it would be until you got to the last lap, because you didn't know where Fernando was going to finish.
Yes.
In Abu Dhabi, was just absolutely astonishing. Yeah. And it's something I kind of, you know, when I joined Red Bull, it was mainly to be involved as a fresh challenger with the team, more or less from the start.
Yeah.
With the aspiration of trying to drive it up the grid and maybe win a race or two.
Yes.
To kind of make it a championship winning team, or for it to become a championship winning team, was amazing.
And what is it that, I mean, this is, I haven't done the maths, but this must be your 16th season with them?
Yes. Yeah, that's a bit frightening.
So you've stayed here, I would say, more than twice as long as any other team you've ever been with. Yeah. And I'm just wondering what it is about this place and this team where you have clearly felt so at home, and not being tempted elsewhere, because I'm sure you've had offers.
Yeah, I think it's that being involved in start business. So yeah. Christian and I, I think, have a very strong relationship, where we just trust each other to get on the other with our respective sides of the business. He also gives me a lot of freedom in terms of getting involved in other things, Valkyrie or whatever it might be. Responsibility, or feeling responsible, I don't know if paternal is too strong a word, but kind of, because being involved in it more or less from the start, then I feel more emotionally attached to it than perhaps I did with either Williams or McLaren, where I suppose
you joined already very established teams.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And felt a little bit more transient as an important employee, hopefully, but still another employee.
Yeah.
So I think, had Leighton House not hit its problems, and Leighton House had its proper funding and been able to grow and expand and develop in the way that we have here at Red Bull, then maybe I'd have stayed at Leighton House for the rest of my days. But since Leighton House, it's the Williams and McLaren, as I just felt more a key employee than
part of the actual fabric of the
place. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had those four on the trot with Sebastian, and then obviously we sort of enter what I think people sort of perceive as being the sort of Mercedes era.
Yeah.
But it's coming back to you now, isn't it? I mean, I'm just trying to think about last season. I mean, that was an absolute battle royal, wasn't it?
It was.
And I don't know, I mean, you know, I have, you know, for a long time, you know, I got a bit cynical about Formula One, and but it was, I mean, it must have been, the pressure on you guys must have been absolutely extraordinary. But I wonder whether you thrive on that sort of pressure. And whether actually you'll look back at that season and think, well, that was amazing. And does it gall you at all that although you did get the Drivers' Championship, the Constructors eluded you just?
It does, but I mean, you've got to be philosophical about these things. We could have... It would have taken very little difference for us to have won both. Equally, it would have taken very little difference for us to have lost both.
Yes.
So you've got to be happy. I think Max thoroughly deserved the Drivers' Championship, so I'm happy for him, and I'm happy for the team. I think most people, if you ask which would you rather win, not forget the driver himself, but if people are within the team, which would you rather win, the drivers or the constructors, they would say the drivers, because it's kind of the one that people remember more. You tend to remember so-and-so won that championship, oh, and he was driving a Williams or a McLaren or a Red Bull or whatever it is. Yeah, it was a very tough championship. We generally speaking, I think, had the quicker car, but not always. We had, I think, Silverstone and then Hungary were obviously huge blips. And then there's kind of, it was a very dirty championship. It was, I think, apart from perhaps the 94 one with Michael and Benetton, then it was the dirtiest championship I've ever been involved in terms of just the vitriol and underhandedness that went on behind the scenes that is too early to talk about at the moment.
Okay, but didn't leave a good taste in the mouth.
Left a bad taste in the mouth, yeah. Mm. Yep.
So I'm speaking to you just over halfway through the 2022 season, and things are, fair to say, going very well. It must be your best start to a season in... Well, since those Vettel days in the beginning of the last decade. And I was just wondering, you know, you have done so much, and not just in Formula One, but obviously in Indy and in sports cars. You had you briefly went and helped Ben Ainslie with the America's Cup boat. There's the Valkyrie, which you were obviously integral to that. And there's now the RB17, which you're starting to work on that. Are there any ambitions left there? Is there anything that you really want to do which you haven't done yet?
I mean, what I have enjoyed, I think what's so brilliant about motor racing is its combination of design and competition.
Yeah.
So, obviously, lots of my friends from university on the aeronautical course then went to work for British Aerospace, Rolls-Royce, etc. And Rolls-Royce engines.
Yes.
And there they would be working on projects that aren't going to fly for 10, 15 years. So by which time, of course, you've moved on to something completely different. So there's no particular feedback of whether you're doing a good, bad or indifferent job.
Yeah.
Motor racing, every 2 weeks or so,
you
get a reminder of which of those three you're in, which obviously when it's the bad job is painful,
yes.
But you got to accept that as part of the thing. So I think that kind of competition, the fact that, you know, it's obviously an old thing of likening it to war, I think that's a bit strong, but it is, you are developing under pressure and at the fastest rate you can within your resources, which in that sense, I guess it's like war. I do enjoy that challenge. To answer your question then, I think that combination of design and competition has been a fascinating one, hence also the interest in America's Cup as being probably the only other area outside of Formula One where you've got big budget design competition. But I also have also, I guess because of my father and my upbringing, always been interested in road cars. And so if I was to be involved in something different again, I think nowadays it would probably be automotive, but I couldn't do it for a big company.
No. It is interesting that, you know, obviously you are in the most sort of, you know, you live at the white hot cutting edge of the state of the art, and yet there has been nostalgia there, isn't there?
Mm.
You look at the cars that you choose to own and the cars you choose to go out and enjoy, they're all sort of 40, 50, 60 years old. And I think that's probably quite a rare thing for people who do what you do. My guess is that most people are only looking to the future, only looking forward to the next race. But you, away from the racetrack, you're actually, I mean, I'm looking around here, you've got, you know, paintings of old cars and that sort of thing. And it's clearly quite an important part of your life.
It is. I mean, I think it's, yeah, I guess it is nostalgia, but I appreciate the sort of design purity of old cars, and understanding what the designers must have been doing. I think that 70s period in particular,
yes,
must have been a fascinating, you know, that sort of 1970 through to when the ground effect came in.
Yeah.
Must have been a fascinating area to work in, and a very frustrating one, because you had the exact opposite of what we have now. Then you had a rule book was about 3 pages.
Yes.
And but a very almost non-existent research facilities in terms of budget or tools,
yeah,
wind tunnels, simulation tools, whatever. So he saw it all the time that a designer would come up with his grand new idea,
yeah,
which he dreamt up that night,
yes,
or the night before, drawn it, made the car, and if he'd done it well, then the car was this tremendous success, and if he hadn't, then it wasn't, and if it wasn't, he probably had no idea why. So it must have been, he had this plethora, you know, he had this almost prehistoric explosion of different shapes of cars in,
yeah,
the mid-70s.
Yes.
Everyone looking completely different to each other.
Yeah, but they all had the same, well, most of them had the same engine and most of them had the same gearbox,
yeah,
and you know, there was an awful lot of commonality to them too, wasn't,
yeah,
there?
There was, but then in terms of the shape and the...
Completely different.
Yeah, completely different.
Yeah, and do you inherently lean towards a bigger or a small rule book? Would you rather there were fewer regs than more?
I would love to have fewer regs.
Would that be not just more fun, but do you think that would give you more creative space to build a relatively better, quicker car than you can do under?
It would. The danger, I think, the problem is, first of all, you'd have to keep the safety regulations in, clearly.
Yeah.
I think nowadays, under the cost cap, you can contain the cost argument, because that was always one of the arguments against a more open rule book, is that the costs would just spiral out of control. But with the cost cap, then that argument falls away.
Yes.
I think probably the big reticence for that is the fear that one team will...
Thinks of something.
Something, and just it'll and become a boring race because that,
yeah,
team disappears.
Yeah. Okay, last car.
Last car. Right, this is... You won't expect this one, which is, again, a car I do own, in which the kids are now grown up, so with my wife Amanda, we our dogs, then we kind of drive around. We have a place in Cape Town as well. So both here and in Cape Town, we have a VW camper van. split screen, mid-60s, and it's... It's clearly the slower than a slow thing,
yeah,
but it's great fun, and we just go off and drive around
and you can
take the dogs with it. Not really fun, honestly. in South Africa, we tend to go to drive to what do you call it? Not game reserves, wildlife reserves.
Yes.
In the UK, we'll do it just to.
But you'll still go off and do big distances, right?
Yeah. Well, not too big, but it takes too long. But. Good fun.
Brilliant. Okay, so now we're at the end now, so you just have to tell me, for your last ever drive, which one of those six cars you would choose to be in, and where you would choose to do it and who, if anybody, you would choose to be with.
Oh, well, I didn't read the small print there. I didn't realise I had to choose from one of those six cars.
Oh, it's got to be one of the six.
Ah, okay. Well, I was going to say that I think most beautiful road, I think, there's some fabulous roads in Tuscany and round Siena in Italy. As a single road, I would choose a road called Chapman's Peak, which runs between Camps Bay and Nortuk, just outside Cape Town. Mm. It's a coastal road. It's elevated. You sometimes see whales if you're lucky out, loads of seals and so forth. Just absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
And it's also a great cycling road. So Eddie Jordan has a house just down the road from us in Camps Bay, and I go out cycling with him along that road quite regularly, just because it's so pretty.
What are you driving on it? The Ferrari?
On that road, yes, the California has to be the absolute ideal car.
That's the thing, is it? Yeah. Okay, so it's the Ferrari, it's the California on that road. And yeah. Are you on your own, or have you got somebody with you?
Basically, I've got to say my wife, haven't I? Otherwise, if she listens to this podcast and I don't say her, it just won't be worth coming home.
Fantastic. Adrian Newey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It has genuinely been a really great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Enjoyed it. Thank you.